Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Well, that question, where would we be without books, is of special relevance today, because I'm going to be talking to my guest about a book that we could easily have not had. And it changed everything. It was subjected to censorship all over the world, and the author has taken us back to that great fight to get what was known to be perhaps the greatest, most difficult book ever written into people's hands. The book I'm talking about is James Joyce's Ulysses. The book we're discussing is the most dangerous book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, by my guest, Kevin Birmingham. And you dedicate this book to your father, who taught you about free expression. And you have in this book an extraordinary understanding of the history of censorship, that it wasn't really at first about dirty words or even about moral looseness, loose morality. Tell me the beginning of the story of censorship of literature in America.
Well, it has deep roots, really. Legally, the roots actually go to England and to the United Kingdom. And the standards for censorship in the U.S. were borrowed from British courts. And the so-called Hicklin Rule, which is that basically says that a book is obscene if it has the tendency to deprave and corrupt anyone whose minds are open to such influences and into whose hands such material may fall. It was a very stringent rule. It effectively meant that it didn't matter if a book was intended to be artistic, if it was intended to be political. If it had the tendency to corrupt anyone, it could be a child, then it was punishable and it was illegal. The reason why this rule developed the way it did was not because of sexuality itself. It was because of a series of religious skirmishes in the Midlands in the UK, where basically Protestants and Catholics were rioting. And they're rioting because of the distribution of a pamphlet called The Confessional Unmasked, which was a series of questions and answers that might have been proposed to a priest when in the confessional, and a parishioner might ask, is sex in a certain position, is that a sin? Is it a grievous sin or is it a minor sin? And so forth.
So essentially, it was a pamphlet instructing priests about how to deal with certain problematic sexual positions.
Right, and it's effectively sounds like a legal tract, because the young priests have to prepare themselves for any eventuality. So if a widow says, might ask the priest, is it a sin for me to think about my deceased husband while having intercourse with my current husband? And the priest had to have an answer to that.
Well, that's a dirty book, isn't it?
In a way, it was a dirty book, but it was distributed specifically to incite anti-Catholic sentiment.
Yes.
And the Protestant League that was distributing it wanted to defend it on the grounds that it wasn't really about sex. It had a political message. And the court effectively said, well, no, it's obscene. And the reason why it's obscene is not because of the intent, but it's because of how it would affect anyone who might happen to get it.
So it's not the priest who will be made libertine. It's the accidental discovery of the book by
right.
someone hungry to read about immoral positions anyway, who could become impressionably made dissolute.
Yes, the Murphy riots, as they were called, because they were stoked by a Protestant, a former Irish Catholic, and he converted to Protestantism, was distributing the pamphlets, and it was covered in the press, and it was well known that young people were getting a hold of the pamphlets.
Now, it's fascinating because one of the things that Joyce does in Ulysses is to show us that probably your mother and father had what would be called sinful mm-hmm. thoughts.
Yeah.
When you hear what Leopold Bloom, the older male hero of Ulysses, thinks about during the day,
mm-hmm.
when you hear what his wife, Molly, thinks of in bed, it's as if these people have this on their minds all the time, and in fact, they do. Joyce decides that he will write about the secret inner life of everyone. That's one of his subject matters. And the truth of the matter is that an authoritarian state wants to prosecute the secret inner life of everyone. And eventually, well, how do we communicate privately? Through the mail at the time. Mm-hmm. And the post office in America becomes in charge of determining what is obscene. Imagine the postmaster
yeah.
is the man in charge of public morals. How does that happen?
It was one of the fascinating sidelights for me is figuring out how obscenity was enforced. And then realizing, you know, in the mid to late 19th century and into the early 20th century, the post office was a major law enforcement organization. Federal law enforcement officials were actually very small. The Bureau of Investigation, it wasn't yet the FBI, but the Bureau of Investigation was tiny. The Secret Service was tiny, but the post office... There were post offices everywhere. There were thousands, I think were 56,000 postmasters scattered around the country. There were hundreds of postal inspectors who were charged and authorized to take a look at what was being distributed in the country. And if they deemed something obscene, because these things are not in envelopes, they're, you know, newspapers and magazines are being distributed through the mail, then they had the authority to take it out of circulation. So if you ran afoul of the post office and you had a publication and the post office wasn't going to mail it out to any of your readers or subscribers, you were in trouble. You were effectively out of business.
Well, listen to this. The thing that I learned from your book, of course, was that they were not looking either for sexual material, really,
mm-hmm.
or for suspicious literary material, they were looking for anarchists, bomb-throwing,
yeah.
assassination-provoking Emma Goldmans.
Right.
And where was this material to be found? In the literary and culture magazines at the time.
Ulysses was being serialized in the Little Review, which was a modernist magazine published in Greenwich Village by Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap. And it was serialized beginning in 1918. And in 1919, a copy of the Little Review got into the hands of the Translation Bureau. And the Translation Bureau was still up and running, even though the war was officially over, because they were charged with making sure that anything that was in a foreign language was not, there were no secrets, war secrets, there was no espionage being somehow encoded into foreign language text. So the Espionage Act effectively made it illegal for you to discredit the U.S. government or the U.S. Army or discourage people from wanting to enlist in the draft.
Run around the block three times and do not think of the words Homeland Security.
Yeah, right, right.
Because that's what this is about. I'm talking to Kevin Birmingham. He's written a book called The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, and it really is a revelation of how the fight against Ulysses became part of the idea that literature, if we can't understand it, must be seditious. And so they looked at it, yeah. They'd see the occasional dirty word, and they said, oh, I don't want my daughter to see that four letters in a row. It must be itself immoral. You could quote whole sentences that would be thought of as immoral, but the average hip-hop song is much more arousing and disturbing.
Seditious,
right? Seditious.
Yes. Well, you... basically, the sorts of people who are interested in writing experimental fiction like Joyce, like Joyce's fiction, were also interested in experimental ideas about politics. And they were naysayers, they were rebels, they were renegades. The reason why the government was keeping such a close eye on the Little Review is because the Little Review was a vocal advocate of Emma Goldman, who happened to be the single most important anarchist in the United States at the time.
But also feminist, and the editors of the Little Review were feminists.
Right.
And they lived in Greenwich Village, of course, yes.
And that was dangerous, and they were homosexual, and she advocated for gay rights. She was one of the first women to do so publicly in a magazine in 1915. So the government had long been keeping an eye on the Little Review, and that's how a Translation Bureau employee happened to see a portion of Ulysses. He forwarded it to his supervisor. And then in a later episode, there's a scene, you know, Leopold Bloom is having lunch, and he tastes the Burgundy, and the Burgundy reminds him of the sun and this beautiful sun over Hotead, which is this hill outside of Dublin. And it reminds him of this moment between himself and Molly, and he talks about her nipples, and they're kissing each other, and it's really this beautiful moment where she has seed cake in her mouth, and she kisses him, and he takes some of the seed cake, and they're chewing it together. And it's really the moment when they're falling in love. And so the first scene that was banned by the government was really one of the central scenes of love in Ulysses.
They're swapping spit.
Yeah. You know, the first trial was against the Little Review in 1921, and the editors faced jail time for it. And it was not under federal law. It was actually they were being prosecuted under New York state law. But the state laws mirrored the federal laws. And even by 1933, when you get the federal trial, Morris Ernst, who was an ACLU co-founder, had kept trying to invoke the First Amendment to defend books like Ulysses.
Freedom of speech.
He kept getting shot down. No one wanted to accept the argument. No one believed that the First Amendment could cover a novel or a marital pamphlet, a marital aid, or a pamphlet about contraception. These days, we do see that as freedom of speech, as being covered under our larger understanding of what the First Amendment actually protects. But at the time, no one thought that at all. It was explicitly political speech. And if it wasn't political speech, if it wasn't about a rally, if it wasn't about a war, if it wasn't about capital, the way capital flowed in society or something like that, then you could forget it. So by the time Morris Ernst defended Ulysses, he had given up on even trying to invoke the First Amendment. So his way of defending Ulysses is by saying obscenity and a literary classic can't go hand in hand. You have to be one or the other, and you have to choose. If something is a classic, it is by definition not obscene. And so he was trying to sell Judge Woolsey, who was the federal judge presiding over the case, that the book was so good that it transformed the dirty parts of Ulysses into art.
Now, these prosecutors have reams of folders in which these problematic words like nipple, because they didn't like that really any better than some of the words that, by the way, we still can't say over the air on National Public Radio after all.
Right.
This is not a story that's over. This is the beginning of the story. It's a story that will include Henry Miller. It will include William Burroughs. It will include D.H. Lawrence.
Right.
That we happen to have a period of great laxness right now doesn't mean that there aren't working people who would love to clamp down again. They don't like to see these things taught in schools, not even the greatest books.
obscenity is as illegal today as it was in 1922. The laws are still on the books. The only difference between today and 1922 is the way in which the courts define obscenity. And the Ulysses trial started to change. It was the big turning point in how obscenity was being redefined. These days, if you are trying to defend a book or a radio program or a movie against charges of obscenity, all you have to do is show that your program or your book has an ounce of what the courts call redeeming social value. And if it has that, then it's not obscene. But that's new. That wasn't until 1957.
And it's still contestable.
Yes, right.
Yes.
It's still, right, you could still be...
What is redeeming social value if that can also be seen as sedition? Well, after the sinful literary magazine, The Little Review, called The Little Review, publishes excerpts of Ulysses, the murmurs that something extraordinary is afoot begin, but the book doesn't get published by a publisher. Publishers can be sued and hung out to dry if they publish the book. So a bookshop in Paris called Shakespeare and Company, led by a woman named Sylvia Beach, publishes the first edition of Ulysses. But what does she find? She can't mail it anywhere in America because the mail has decreed it to be
Obscene, basically. really obscene, lewd, lascivious, salacious, indecent, foul. All these words were being used in the statutes to make sure that you nab any book that you don't really want. So when Sylvia Beach had just published it, she was mailing copies to subscribers, to people who had paid for Ulysses before it was published, who lived in the United States. And they usually didn't even get into the hands of the post office. They were already being snatched by customs officials. So there were customs laws against importing obscenity. So,
and if it was found in someone's luggage, who bought a copy in Paris to bring home to the people who were hungering for this strange book that they'd heard about, well, it could be taken away.
So the way people got around it was they would buy a copy of Ulysses at Shakespeare and Company, and then they would rebind it in a cover that would say Shakespeare's Complete Works or the Holy Bible or something like that. And so by the time you went back to the United States and the customs official was looking at what you had, he'd see the Bible, hopefully not open it, and then just let you through.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Kevin Birmingham about his book, the most dangerous book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses. We'll continue after this short break.
At any given moment on KCRW, you might hear Spoon performing live on Morning Becomes Eclectic, or Michael Silverblatt talking to Edward St. Hoban, or a conversation about race and politics on Press Play. This is programming of a very special kind. It's radio for the curious. Support your curiosity. Become a member of KCRW today and sustain the music, news, and culture that satisfies your need to know. Go to kcrw.com/join and thank you.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Kevin Birmingham about his new book, The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, the story behind one of the most controversial fellows in literature, Leopold Bloom. Now, I want to say that your book is part of the battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, because what you've done in one fell swoop is to make Ulysses interesting again. You make the people who participate in the fight for Ulysses interesting, eccentric, sexual, fantastically provocative. Along comes, who do we have? Ezra Pound, the provocateur of the last century, who taught the great William Butler Yeats that James Joyce was a great writer, who got T.S. Eliot to believe it too. In fact, who got T.S. Eliot? We wouldn't be thinking what we think about The Wasteland or Proof Rock if it weren't for Pound telling the people at the little literary magazine, this is the important poem to publish, and the little literary magazine is being looked at by the post office. Why? Well, poetry is so famously seditious. Poetry alters the course of wars. Poetry alters the course of consciousness. And we knew that in the 1920s better than we know it now, it seems to me. Because getting someone to read Ulysses now, what do your students know? You teach at Harvard. You're getting them to read Ulysses.
Yeah, they won't necessarily know anything about Ulysses before, you know, sitting down. A lot of people at this point don't necessarily know about Dubliners or A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. I think these books are being taught less and less in high school and in college. So it's not easy. But honestly, you know, the thing that I've really wanted to do with this book is to pull it out of the classrooms. And I think the classroom has been a problem for Ulysses because people think of it as a book for pedants, a book for scholars, a book for people who don't really love books, a book for people who just want to show off their education rather than really dive into a book. And that's not at all the way Ulysses was for the first two or three decades of its life. When Ulysses was first published, the reviews that were coming out in 1922 were astonished. We have reviewers who are comparing Joyce to an anarchist with a bomb who's trying to blow up all of English literature. The scathing comments go, you know, into the 50s and 60s. Even D.H. Lawrence was astounded by it. And of course, D.H. Lawrence ends up having censorship troubles of his own, but he thought that the final chapter of Ulysses was the most obscene thing he had ever read. So I wanted to resurrect the early life of Ulysses, where it wasn't a book for the classrooms. It wasn't a book for people who were buttoned up and considered themselves proper. It was a book for the rebels. It was a book for feminists. It was a book for radicals, for anarchists, for people who were sexually forward-thinking, for people who were experimental. And I think we've lost a lot when we lose that initial life of Ulysses. And
yes, well, I was thrilled because I read an extraordinarily positive review. The reviews of my guest Kevin Birmingham's book, The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, are ecstatic. And you write so clearly, and you write narratively, and you write well. So I said, I'm going to reread Ulysses. And I discovered you can't lie. You can't say Ulysses isn't a hard book.
Yeah, right? It's very hard.
It's really hard. But what if it turned out that the book is about the world being hard to live in? Mm-hmm. Change is constant. I'm sitting across from you. I don't know what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. Not just of me. I don't know who the first thing about you. Mm-hmm. Your private life, your personal life. You're looking at me. You didn't know before today that I've read Ulysses four or five times and love it dearly and deeply, and that I read it again because you reinterested me in it. I never thought I'd be reading it again in this life. It's hard. And yet the book is about, on every page, the fact that we know maybe less than 20% of what we need to know in order to live, in order to be alive. We don't know what happens when we turn on our cell phone. We don't know necessarily about electricity even. Leopold has some idea. He's constantly thinking these funny science thoughts that he has, but none of them are accurate.
Yeah.
Everyone in the book is exchanging gossip that may or may not be true. Ulysses is full of moments. Leopold says he's going to throw away a flyer, and someone hears the word throw away and thinks it's a tip on a horse race.
Right.
And they bet on the horse throwaway and win. And they think, therefore, Leopold must have made a lot of money, too. They want him to stand drinks.
He must be a mason.
He must be, yes. He must be secretly in the know.
Right.
And he must be a miser, a Jew, because he won't buy the drinks after winning in the horse race. And everything is the product of misunderstanding.
Right. This little accident.
That's the difficulty of Ulysses. It describes how hard it is to get through a single day without hundreds and thousands of misimpressions.
I think, you know, the way writers are told to write generally is to write in such a way that the reader's brow will never really furrow too much and you will minimize confusion as much as possible. And that effectively you're being served the information without it really seeming as if you're being served. This is the way, the standard way we read books or the way books are being written. Joyce was not interested in doing that at all. And he was not interested in serving the reader. What he wanted is for readers to be able to come to him and to come into this day, this June 16th, 1904. And he said something at one point that I think is really revealing. He said, you know, rather than have a million readers, what I want is to have one reader who would read my book a million times. And it's a little bit of a joke, but there's a seriousness to it. What he wanted was a certain intimacy with reading. And that intimacy is in paying careful attention, leaning in to the book, and really focusing on what's happening, and to be willing to read it time and time again. And that's the effect that you get with Ulysses, is that even when you're done, you think to yourself, there's so much more here for me if I want it.
Well, we're going to continue talking about it, because I think Joyce knew, if I make the church angry at me, if I make the Puritans angry at me, if I make people curious about these so-called sexual fantasies that occur in the book, well, there's a big blooming audience for a difficult book if I flirt with them. And Ulysses, as my guest Kevin Birmingham demonstrates, is a book that flirts with its readers like crazy, and we'll be talking about that next week. I've been talking with Kevin Birmingham, author of the most dangerous book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, published by Penguin Press. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director, Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.